everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm Jace, flying solo on this episode. I'm going to be talking about the DC books for December 7th, so let's dive right into it. The first book I'm going to talk about is Aquaman number 12. This was written by Dan Abnett, art by Felipe Barones, and colors by Gabe Eltab. So this book really kicks into high gear what the book has been leading up to for a while, basically since the series started, and that is a surface, or a war with the surface, I guess you'd say, between Atlanta and the surface world. And this really, as I said, kicks it into high gear. It's been a long time coming, and I really like the ending. The Justice League shows up. They had shown their support for Arthur Curry, for Aquaman, after he had had the battle with Shaggy Man. Things with Superman weren't left on the best of terms. He allowed Aquaman to return to Atlantis with the caveat that he would take care of what he needed to take care of. Aquaman had kind of asked for that. You know, he had said that this was something he needed to do on his own to kind of prove not only to himself but to the rest of the world that Atlantis and the surface world could peacefully coexist. So with this issue, it's the first issue of a new story arc, The Deluge, we see that the forces of Nemo and Black Manta specifically attack the surface world with the appearance of being Atlantis. They have Atlantean weapons, they have Atlantean vehicles, and they're using hit-and-run tactics to make their numbers appear much greater than they actually are. The world immediately declares war on Atlantis, understandably so, and Aquaman is left in the middle trying to both discover how Nemo is doing this, to find proof so he can clear Atlantis's good name, at the same time knowing he's going to have to defend Atlantis from retaliation from the surface. So much like this book has been right from the beginning, a very political book, a very appropriate book in today's political climate, I think, and a very interesting book. It's a different take on Aquaman, him as a political figure, very much exploring his role as ruler and king of Atlantis, rather than focusing on the superheroic side. Other than the issues where he fought the Shaggy Man, he really hasn't been action in the way of Aquaman facing off against threats. So while I greatly enjoyed the New 52 Aquaman title that Geoff Johns wrote, that was a much more insular book in a way, in as much as it just focused on Aquaman as kind of an individual, as sort of a superhero facing more physical threats. Threats he could overcome through the use of his physical powers. This tale that Dan Abnett is telling is much more cerebral. The challenges are much greater. Aquaman can't punch his way out of these situations. It's very compelling, very well done. If there's any complaint I have about the series, it's how little of Brad Walker's art we've seen. And I know he's one of my favorite artists, so obviously I'm disappointed when he's not on the book. I know that he wishes he could be on the book more, that he could do more issues. And he kind of shot himself in the foot, so to speak, when he designed Aquaman's rebirth costume. He made it so intricate with the pebble design for Aquaman's shirt that he's spending hours on it per page, and it's really slowing him down. So I always look forward to when he does issues. That's not to say Felipe Barones' art is not good. It is, especially in the action scenes. But I just feel like his storytelling isn't quite as free-flowing and as smooth as Brad's is. Certainly his emotion in the faces is not as great. And then, of course, Brad's art just has that weight to it, that real depth of feeling that Felipe's doesn't. Felipe's is much more traditional comic art, whereas Brad's is a little more dynamic. There just seems to be a lot more to please the eye, at least for me. So hopefully Brad will be back next issue. Look forward to seeing the way the Justice League interacts with Aquaman now that they believe that he has attacked the surface world. We'll see if he can convince them otherwise. So Aquaman number 12, really, really great issue. One of the better issues of the series so far. All right, up next, we have Batman number 12, written by Tom King, pencils by Mikhail Yanin, inks by Hugo Petrus and Mikhail Yanin, and colors by Jun Chung. Tom King is an incredible writer. He's proved that time and time again. What's interesting is when you talk to him and he talks about the fact that he likes to, I don't know if experiment is the right word, but he likes to keep things fresh. He likes to look for new ways to tell stories, things that haven't been done before. This entire issue of Batman, number 12, in the I Am Suicide arc, it's all double page spreads, really showcasing Mikhail Yanin's art. I'm a huge fan of Mikhail Yanin. His art is incredibly dynamic, very detailed, and these pages, I can't imagine how long it took him to draw this. The art is just absolutely incredible, from the page layouts to the panel layouts. The colors by Jun Chung, very moody, very appropriate. The colors are just really sets the mood. The backgrounds, so much detail. It's just really an incredible book. And, you know, I received my advanced copies. They're digital. That is kind of one of the drawbacks. This is a book that you definitely are going to want to see, hold in your hands and flip through and take a look at these incredible pages. It's just absolutely amazing. As for the story itself, it's actually a little light on story, but in a way that's okay because the art is so dynamic. It doesn't really need a lot of words. And I know that Manny had said he didn't care much for the issue. You know, we've seen the last two issues be letters back and forth. One letter from Catwoman to Batman. This one is from Batman to Catwoman. It gives some insight into their relationship. Some insight that I can't ever remember really reading about before. And that's okay. I appreciate what Tom King is trying to say. I can also understand where Manny's coming from. It does come across, or can come across, as a little pretentious. And it certainly doesn't make for the most action-packed of issues. It's more about emotion and the relationship between Batman and Catwoman, which in a way is almost in direct contradiction to what you're seeing as the visuals. So it makes for an interesting reading experience, and I'm sure that's exactly what Tom King was going for. And I have a feeling that for a lot of your average comic readers, it might be boring, or it just maybe doesn't make a lot of sense. So I can definitely understand that, but I mean, it's worth it just to buy it for the art alone. I mean, I think if you stacked up all the words, all the dialogue boxes, it probably would fill maybe 2-3 pages. So there's not a lot there as far as dialogue and scripting, but the story is told beautifully through Mikhail Yanin's art. So I would say, at the very least, if you're not reading Batman, you're in the comic shop, pick it up and flip through it, because it's absolutely amazing from an art perspective. I do agree with Manny, though, that I'm ready for this I Am Suicide Squad story to actually do something. I mean, really, all we've seen is Batman recruit the team, go to Santa Prisia and escape from a cell, and Catwoman betray him. the really, I mean, especially being that this is the third or fourth issue in the story arc, I think the fourth issue, not much has happened yet, so I'm ready to get to the meat of the story. All right, up next we have Cyborg number 6, written by John Semper Jr. The art in issue 6 is by Will Conrad, and the colors are by Ivan Nunez. So this is the appearance of a variant, or She Cyborg, as I've heard her called. She basically has the same origin as Victor Stone Cyborg. They open up a boom tube, they somehow connect it to her body, use it to repair the damaged parts. I'm not going to spoil what happens in the end. Needless to say, it's kind of touching in a way to see Cyborg finally have someone, another human, another person on Earth that he can kind of confide in and he can talk to on another level, who understands what it means to be a cyborg. At no point in his life as Cyborg, before this variant character comes along, has he ever had someone that he could connect to on that level that understands what he's gone through, right? Nobody understands. They go into the cyberspace area that up until that point, he'd never shown another living person. So there are things that like that that he shares with Variant. And so you can kind of understand as the story unfolds with him taking Variant into the Cyberverse, with him sharing with her the newfound ability to manipulate his cybernetic parts to look human, to appear human. You can kind of understand how they have a connection so fast. You can understand, even though I was a bit dubious, you can understand why he becomes so close to this person so fast when he really doesn't know that much about her. It all makes sense because he, in a way, has been alone since the moment he became Cyborg. So what I like about the series, and John Semper Jr. has been doing this the entire time, it's really exploring who Victor Stone is as a person, much more than it's exploring who Cyborg is as a hero. If there's anything wrong with that, it's that in the pages of Justice League, Cyborg was much more came across as much more confident than he does in this solo book. And because of that, he comes across as older in that book. And I know there were times in the Geoff Johns Justice League run that specifically Johns tried to make Cyborg seem younger, particularly when he had him interact with Shazam. Billy Batson, who basically was a 13-year-old kid in the body of this superpowered adult. And so I appreciated that, but still, Cyborg always came across as more confident, older, more experienced. Semper has him questioning just about everything that he thinks about himself or thinks he knows about himself. And so it makes him seem younger. So there's a little bit of a disconnect there. But I don't mind it necessarily because I'm enjoying this exploration of who Victor Stone is as a person and the doubts that he has about himself. Is he still human? Does he have a soul? What does it mean that he's half man, half machine? Where does the machine end and the man start and vice versa? And so all that is so compelling and so intriguing. It's really a nitpick to talk about kind of the difference in personality that we've seen from Cyborg in the New 52 and what we've seen in Rebirth so far. So really good book. The art by Will Conrad, it's a little inconsistent. There are times when I think his art looks absolutely spectacular. There are other times where it just looks a little wonky. I don't know if it's the rendering or just perspective, maybe anatomy. It just looks a little weird sometimes. I can't fault the colors at all by Ivan Nunez. He does a really great job showing the electricity, the crackle, the lights on both Variant and Cyborg. Their particular cybernetic parts look like they're glowing. It's very well done. The mother box, again, the color effects on that are done very well. I do like the page layouts that Will Conrad is doing. You can definitely tell that he's putting some thought into it and keeping things interesting by changing them up. I don't think there's a single page where the panel layouts are repeated. Pretty much every page is unique in and of itself. So a solid issue. Cyborg continues to be a very underrated series, maybe the most underrated series in DC Rebirth so far. All right, the next book I'm going to talk about is Dead Man, Dark Mansion of Forbidden Love, number 2. This is written by Sarah Vaughn with art by Lan Medina. Some help on breakdowns for the second chapter by Phil Hester, and the colors are by Jose Villarubia. Really enjoyed this issue. I liked the first issue a lot. Second issue, I think I enjoyed even more. There was less of Dead Man in the second issue. It really kind of focused on the main human character of the book and a little bit on the ghost that Dead Man had met toward the end of issue number 1. So this is 3 issues total. This is the second issue, and the mystery is no closer to being solved. We do have a few more of the pieces, but we haven't got there yet. But it's, again, a compelling story. As I said, this second issue really focuses on the main human character, Bernice, much more so than on Dead Man. And I feel like this is I like that they did this. So it's Dead Man, Dark Mansion of Forbidden Love. There used to be a DC title in the Silver Age, I believe, the late Silver Age, called Dark Mansion of Forbidden Love or something along that line, some kind of a romance slash horror book, you know, those old romance stories with some supernatural elements is kind of a trope back in the day, very much a genre in and of itself. So this story is really tapping into that. Vaughn does an incredible job of making the characters seem relatable with the dialogue, making it creepy, and keeping that mystery going. The art by Lan Medina is really, really well done. Tends to be a little on the photorealistic side, or as photorealistic as you can be with a couple of ghosts in it. But the attention to detail in this ancient manor is impeccable. The page layouts are well done. It's got a very much of a cinematic feel. The characters all look unique. They have their own look. There's a bit of their own style. The colors by Villarubia help set the mood. They're a little muted. They tend to be a little toward the dark end of the spectrum, so it suits the horror feel, the creepiness of the book very well. So I'm very much looking forward to the conclusion of this story, and I think it's going to read great in a trade. So for those of you that are fans of Dead Man, I would highly recommend picking this up or at least picking the trade up when it comes out. All right, the next book I'm going to talk about is Death of Hawkman number 3. This is another miniseries written by Mark Andraco. Pencils are by Aaron Lopresti, inks by John Livesay, and the colors are by Blonde. So we still haven't gotten the full story with what exactly is going on with Hawkman and Adam Strange. I think every book in the series so far, every issue, has been flashback. And by that I mean there's a couple of pages that are set in the now, so to speak, and then it flashes back, and we're still trying to understand how Adam Strange and Hawkman came to be in the position they're in when we meet them in the first issue. So there's been very little progression from where we see them at when the series starts. There's been very little progression on that. We're still kind of waiting for the backstory and the history of how they ended up where they were to get caught up to where they are now. And I have a feeling that that's perhaps going to happen next issue with issue 4, and then issue 5 and 6 may be resolution, I would think, going forward. And still absolutely no clue why it's called Death of Hawkman. He certainly doesn't seem to be threatened at any point. But I do love the humor that Andraco injects into the book. As far as the art goes, I feel like while it's solid art, it's not Lopresti's best work. I don't know if it's him being teamed up with Livesay or if he just is using a different style. It seems to be a lot less detailed than I'm used to seeing Lopresti's art. The storytelling is still very well done, and I love his panel layouts. Lopresti's a guy who really plays with dimension in his and perspective in his panels, and by that I mean he'll have like one side of the panel will be very much up close on a person's face, and you'll see the person he's talking to maybe toward the middle or the far side of the panel way off in the distance, and so it really gives you that sense of depth, something he's always done, something that I really enjoy about his art. I mean, it's almost a signature kind of style for him. And so I do appreciate that. I just wish there were a little more detail. Of some panels, it's there. And other panels, it seems to be lacking a bit. And the lines seem to be a little heavier than I'm used to seeing from Lopresti. But the colors by Blonde are well done. A lot of primary colors where there needs to be primary. And in the pages with Despero, a lot of flame, a lot of dark colors. So he's done a great job of setting mood and tone, and the colors really fit the setting very well. You know, you think of sci-fi and you think kind of these bright whites and blues, and we definitely see plenty of those colors in the issue. So very much looking forward to getting the full story of how Hawkman and Adam Strange got into the trouble they're in and seeing how the heck they get themselves out of it. And also discovering why they decided to change the title from, I think it was Adam Strange, Hawkman, Out of Time, they changed it from that to Death of Hawkman. So it should be interesting to find that out. Up next we have what I think is the top, if not in the top two, of all Rebirth titles, and that's Green Arrow number 12. Number 12 continues to be written by Benjamin Percy, and this issue, the art is by Otto Schmidt. So that's pencils, inks, colors, the whole nine yards. Emerald Outlaw number 1. Wow, was this a great, great issue. Really starting a new chapter in Green Arrow with Benjamin Percy kind of establishing who Oliver Queen is going to be going forward, as far as the city of Seattle is concerned. And what we learn in this issue is the city of Seattle is not sure who he is. They have varying opinions, and it may depend on the interaction or your own personal taste, the way you see Green Arrow. But we also see that the enemies of Green Arrow seem hell-bent on ruining and besmirching his reputation in Seattle. So it's going to be interesting to see, with the limited resources that Oliver Queen has right now, just how he fights back. As far as the art goes by Otto Schmidt, Juan Frere is my favorite artist on this little trifecta of artists they have going on. Juan Ferreira, Otto Schmidt, and Stephen Byrne. But I cannot fault Otto Schmidt's art at all. It's spectacular. It doesn't have quite the painterly quality that Juan Frere's does. Juan's just looks a little more, almost like it's oil painted, and it's got a little more polish to it. And I think Stephen Byrne's is probably the most animation style. And then you have Otto Schmidt, who's kind of in between that oil painted look of Juan Ferreira and the animation style of Stephen Byrne. You have Otto like right in the middle. Does a great job with faces. The anatomy, he exaggerates a little for effect, which I like. And his page layouts are really, really, really awesome. I love, there's a lot of double page spreads in here, and I love the flow that he uses. It's not one of those things where it's a big double page spread and you're not sure, like you read one word bubble and you're like, okay, wait, which one do I read next? It flows so naturally and smoothly, and I think that's something that can be taken for granted by readers sometimes, and you don't realize how well it's done and how seamlessly your eye moves from one word balloon to the next in the correct order. It's something you don't notice unless it's done incorrectly and you find yourself reading things out of order and realize, oh, the artist didn't do a particularly good job of laying things out on the page so that my eye followed in the proper order. You don't have to worry about that at all with Otto Schmidt. Incredibly, incredibly beautiful book to look at. Really interesting story, especially for a 20-page book. Percy really covers a lot of ground. He gives us kind of the status quo of where Oliver, Black Canary, and John Diggle are when the book starts. Does a great job of establishing how unsure the city is, how they have these differing opinions of who Green Arrow is going forward. We get some clues that there's some kind of secret organization going on, and then it wraps up with an organization that we know all too well deciding that they're going to do whatever they can to turn Seattle against Oliver Queen. So, very interesting. One thing I worry about a little is that this could turn into a bit of a cliche. It could turn into, Robin Hood meets the Fugitive. If Seattle does indeed turn against Oliver Queen and we just see him kind of trying to stay one step ahead of the law, that's a story I've seen and read maybe a little bit too much. I'm not really interested in seeing that. I'm more interested in seeing Oliver come to terms with where he is now in his life, come to terms with the fact that he's lost everything and all he has left is this Green Arrow persona, and exploring whether or not that's enough for him. Exploring whether he can connect with the community of Seattle and be their champion and kind of let go of the past. Because even in this issue, he talks about trying to find a way to clear his name, and Black Canary mentions, you don't need to. All you need is Green Arrow. That's all you need to do what you need to do. And so I'm much more interested in seeing that rather than kind of some kind of misunderstanding with the powers that be trying to capture Green Arrow and him trying to stay one step ahead of the law while being the best hero he can be. Like I said, I think I've just read that story one too many times. All right, up next we have Green Lantern number 12. Green Lantern's number 12 is written by Sam Humphries, pencils by Eduardo Panseca, inks by Julio Ferreira, and colors by Blonde. So this is continuing the story of the Phantom Lantern. We saw at the end of the last issue, he kind of channeled the Orange Lantern greed and avarice, and that's where this issue starts off. And Jessica and Simon confront the Phantom Lantern, Larry, and he basically flees. And where he goes is no big surprise. He goes to Coast City. He's always idolized Green Lantern, particularly Hal Jordan, so it's no surprise that he flees to Coast City. And it doesn't take long for Simon and Jessica to realize right along with us that that's exactly where the Phantom Lantern would go. We also learn in the issue that it's not so much Larry channeling the emotions that he feels through the ring, so much as the ring is feeding off these emotions that he's feeling. So when he feels that he deserves the ring and it all should be his, he turns into an Orange Lantern. It manifests that way. When he gets angry because he feels like in a way he's failed and had to turn table and run, that anger manifests as rage, and again, the ring is feeding off the rage. So he returns to Coast City, as I mentioned. Val Thume is there with the Guardian doing we're not sure what. Clearly he's up to no good. Val Thume's not exactly pleased to see that Larry has returned, knowing that the Green Lanterns can't be far behind. And Simon and Jessica do indeed confront him. But before they do, they have an interesting conversation about how worthy are they of the rings. Jessica seems much more inclined to try to talk to this new Phantom Lantern, because in a way she feels like, you know, the rings said they were worthy, but what if the rings are wrong? Like, what exactly is it that makes them worthy of a ring and not this phantom lantern. And Simon wants to dismiss her claims, but he's self-aware enough to know that perhaps the only reason he wants to dismiss her claims is because he wants to defeat this phantom lantern so badly, and he knows a part of him wants to defeat the phantom lantern because he wants the ring for himself, because his whole thing is maybe just wielding one emotional spectrum isn't enough, and the fact that the phantom lantern ring can tap into them all, maybe there's a little bit being power hungry in Simon. You know, I'm not sure what exactly it is that he thinks he can accomplish by having more power, or why he wants more power. But, you know, I had said after, I think, 2 or 3 issues that I was going to be out on Green Lanterns. And basically, at that point, I was just tired of the mustache twirling of the Red Lanterns. I think that was the biggest reason I wanted to give up the book. I'm very glad I didn't, because this second arc with the Phantom Lantern is really intriguing. I think Sam Humphries is doing a great job. I love the continuing and growing relationship between Simon Boz and Jessica Cruz. There's no romantic tension. There's no attraction between the two, physical attraction or any kind of romantic attraction. They're very much like teammates that don't, and new teammates that don't know how much they can trust one another. And you can tell they even have trouble sometimes trusting themselves. So it makes for a very interesting dynamic, extremely, extremely well written. The art in this particular issue, Eduardo Panseca, I think this is the second issue he's drawn. It's pretty solid. Interesting page layouts. He definitely makes use of the entire page. There's a lot of borderless panels. And it's just, yeah, the strength of his art is definitely his page layouts. There's one page where they're just 8 panels filling up the top 2/3 of the page, and the top 8 are just, the 4 on top are Simon, and we can see the dialogue boxes as he's thinking through. We see his thoughts reflected in the emotions on his face. So it's very well done. And then in the middle 4 panels there, we see Jessica, and it's the same kind of thing. She goes through a range of emotions. Panseca does a great job of expressing that and showing that with very little dialogue. So my hat's off to him. The colors by Blonde. You know, it's a Green Lantern book, so the colors tend to be more in the primary range, which is perfectly fine. A really solid issue this week for Green Lanterns. All right, up next we have Nightwing number 10. This issue was written by Tim Seeley, art by Marcus Toe, and colors by Chris Sotomayor. So this is Dick Grayson deciding that he is going to relocate to Bloodhaven. Basically, he's decided that he's tired of being a globe-trotting super spy. He feels like he's kind of lost touch with who he was as Dick Grayson, and therefore Nightwing. It's not altogether clear why he wants to go to Bloodhaven rather than back to Gotham. It seems to be implied that if he were to go back to Gotham, it would be a crutch in a way, because he has so many members of the Bat family there. He kind of needs to be away from them, not too far away, but just far enough that he's on his own. And this issue really is just a lot of setup. We meet a lot of characters. Dick seems to get a new job, a civilian job, and that looks like it's going to lead to its own complications. So, as I said, very much a setup issue. The art by Marcus Toe is a bit messy for my taste. I don't know that Nightwing has had, in the first 10 issues, an artist who really is in my preferred style. That being said, the storytelling from panel to panel is done well. I think the facial expressions are lacking a little bit, but I know Marcus Toe is a good artist, so I look forward to seeing more of his work on the book. Maybe he just hasn't quite got the feel for Dick Grayson yet. And the colors by Chris Sotomayor, they're well done. It's a bit of a departure from the way Gotham looks. It's not quite as dark, but it's still gritty. It still seems dangerous, and Sotomayor does a great job of setting the mood with some colors that are more on the darker end of the palette, a little drab, which suits a city like Bloodhaven particularly well. All right, the last book I'm going to talk about is Superman number 12, written by Peter J. Tomasi and Patrick Gleason, pencils by Doug Monkey, inks by Jaime Mendoza, probably, and Christian Alame, and colors by Will Quintana. Frankenstein. I can sum this issue up in one word, and that's Frankenstein. Super Monster Part 1. Great cover, showing Frankenstein with an S kind of stitched into his chest. We see Lois talking to the Hamilton County, is it recorder, I think? Or the horn, that's what it is, the Hamilton County horn. Seems interested in doing some work for the newspaper when Frankenstein shows up. And the rest of the issue is pretty much just one big battle. It's very well done. The art by Doug Mankey, very detailed. Especially love all the stitches, bolts, scars, hair, brutal, grim expressions on Frankenstein's face. Just the perfect artist to do this story. I love the farmer in the middle trying to help Superman out. I love the futuristic flying car that Superman had. Just a really, really solid issue. Ends on a bit of a cliffhanger. It's going to be interesting to see if it follows the traditional superhero trope of, okay, two heroes meet, not overly familiar with each other, kind of a misunderstanding. They fight, and then they end up teaming up to save the day. So we've seen the first half in this issue with Frankenstein fighting against Superman and doing an admirable job of holding his own. You know, he does have some roots of his origin in the supernatural, and you know, magic is one of the things Superman's vulnerable to, so you just wonder how much that played into it. But an incredibly beautiful looking issue by Doug Monkey. There's nobody who should be drawing Frankenstein other than Doug Monkey. Just, I love the way his Frankenstein looks. Love the way that Gleason and Tomasi scripted for him. Love his dialogue. So, a really, really fun issue. Didn't have Jonathan in it, though. That's the only complaint that I would have about it. It would have been cool to, even if John was only in a panel or two, kind of watching his dad fight against Frankenstein and just having him be, like, really jazzed about that. You know, just really like, wow, there's a real life Frankenstein's monster. That's totally cool. I can definitely see a 10-year-old or 9-year-old boy getting excited about something like that. So another solid issue for Superman, to be sure. All right, everybody, that's going to do it for this episode. I'd like to remind everyone that we have the 9-panel grid hosted by LRM Online over at the LRM Online website, so be sure to check that out. This week, Manny and I do a spotlight on Suicide Squad in the light of the recently released DVD of the movie. Here at the Comic Source, later on this week, we will have the first of the Marvel Chronology Project spotlighting Secret Wars episode coming out. We'll also have another episode of the Top Cow Chronology Project, as well as an episode covering the books that are coming out on December 14th. So I'd like to thank everyone for joining us. Please visit us at the Comic Source blog for past episodes of the podcast. You can watch episodes of our YouTube channel there, as well as finding links to Manny's written blog and my written blog and our famous sketch gallery. You can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Also do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to keep up to date on new episodes and convention coverage. I'm always sure to post when new episodes come out on our social media sites. So that's really the best way to follow us and to know what we're up to. So thanks for listening, everybody. We'll talk to you next time.